This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman, and today we have something completely different for you. It's the World Cup. And so I have my two long-term producers, Alan Minsky and Melissa Figueroa, are also the hosts of a podcast that they've done now for four World Cups called The People's Game. And if you haven't heard about it, you should, because The People's Game is the intersection of politics, climate, sport, society, rebellion, probably everything else, but with the emphasis on football. So you know who they are. I will be introducing them when we come back and talk to them, you know, for a roundup on the cup so far. And on the second segment today, Alan and Melissa will be interviewing David Goldblatt. He's the author of several pretty extraordinary books on the histories of global soccer or football, including The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, and the recent sequel, The Age of Football, Soccer in the 21st Century. And he has a new article in the London Review of Books that you're going to want to check out about the Qatari World Cup. And Melissa and Alan are going to be interviewing him about that article later in the show. All this when our program returns in just a moment. This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman, and really happy that we're going to do this very special event that happens once every 4 years, and that's the World Cup. And of course, I'm not going to be the person talking about the World Cup, but I'm going to be interviewing our longtime producers, Alan Minsky, who is the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, and Melissa Figueroa, who has so many hats, I never know which one to introduce her under, but she's, you know, working with tech, and she's also a PhD candidate at Berkeley in geography. She's the producer, director, and engineer of this broadcast. And there's just so much more about Melissa that you're going to learn even more about today. So I'm really pleased to have both of you on today. And I know Melissa and Alan have been broadcasting The People's Game, and this is the fourth World Cup that they have done it for. And this is something that has been broadcast on radio and on podcast, and you can usually find it online. And today we're going to bring you a roundup of this week's event from their People's Game broadcast. And one of the things that I started to say in the overall intro is that this is a pretty spectacular podcast because it's the people's game. And so it's not just the sports, it's the sports and the politics and the sports and everything else and all the intersection of sports with all of those other things. So I want to thank you for coming on to do the people's game. And just to start with, I have to say this morning I woke up and looked at Twitter, and I found a tweet by Adam Pajworski. And he's a well-known ex-Marxist East European who writes about the crisis of democracy, but he also wrote about something really important that struck me, you know, maybe two or three decades ago, which was on the concept of conceptual embezzlement. And this was all about the way that Marxism was used against those who would want to rebel in Eastern Europe. And it was a really spectacular concept and essay. So why am I bringing up Adam Pajworski? Because this morning he said, I realize that I may care more about football than politics. And I believe that the final will be Brazil-France 50-50. So that's my intro to you guys. What are your thoughts?
Well, if people listen into today's installment of The People's Game, and we're recording on Saturday, even though on KPFK you're listening to this on Sunday, you will hear that both Melissa and I agree with the person you just cited, and that we think it right now, the two teams that seem the strongest really by far are Brazil and France. So we agree entirely with that assessment. And yes, that's in our minds and in our hearts to a significant degree as or more important than anything that's political. But
let me just go back, because while you go over this, and I'm sure you've done it, you know, in your daily podcast, there's been some spectacular upsets, right, in this cup so far with the very teams that we're talking about. So, you know, maybe I should ask you to comment on that first, and then we're going to go back and I'm going to find out more about why you do this people's game.
Well, I mean, it's a peculiar World Cup in that it's taking place in the middle of the club soccer season almost everywhere in the world. Some of the Northern Hemisphere a very far northern hemisphere leagues are about to take a break for winter for a few months. And the summer break down in South America hasn't really commenced yet. But in the European leagues, where most of the top players play, and that's something that we consider somewhat unfortunate, it's a product of the capital power of the European leagues that they basically buy the best players. They've never had a World Cup before that was in the middle of the season. And consequently, because of the power and influence of money and the power of the private clubs, they had a very short break between when they were playing and when the World Cup began. And so the teams, often including the very best teams who are made up of superstars who all play on different teams, haven't had an opportunity to gel yet as squads. Now, sometimes the smaller countries are immune to that because they're choosing from a much smaller pool of excellent players. So we see this where you see small countries occasionally make deep runs in the World Cup, Croatia being the latest example in the last World Cup. Those 11 players have been playing together their entire generation as they've come of age, and there's very little turnover in the national team. Whereas Brazil, every World Cup cycle, they have 50 exceptional players to choose from, and how is that team going to gel? And they've only had a week off since they were with their clubs. Now, that didn't impact Brazil, who had a brilliant first game, but it certainly seems to have impacted Argentina, even though that's a veteran side, as they lost a huge upset to Saudi Arabia, which is a complete inverse because Saudi Arabia has a rule that you can only be on the national team if you play in the rather non-upper level Saudi league. And so the players all know each other and they've all grown together as a team and they all know each other's play very well. And then Germany also suffered a huge upset to Japan, though not as imbalanced in terms of the national traditions because Japan's been good for a while. Still, it was a huge upset. And now Germany will face against Spain, where they can be eliminated from the World Cup after only two games. And of course, Germany has won four World Cups and as recently as 2 years ago. And while occasionally a top team will be knocked out in the group stage, it's very rare that they're knocked out after only two games. So Germany is really up against it.
And so, Melissa, I see that you're wearing earrings that are big football, soccer balls, which is really attractive, but we're on the radio, so I can only tell the listeners about it. But how did you see these upsets? And then go from there, will you, to what made you to decide to do the People's Game, which, by the way, you can find on Acast and your usual podcasting platform. That's the People's Game. Melissa Figueroa.
Oh, sure. I actually just got handed these as a gift. My compatriot in TEK, Traditional Ecological Knowledge, Ali Mender's Night, she went to the Machupta Indian Market, which was today, which I usually go to every year, but I have to miss for this podcast. But she found some amazing native-made earrings that have a California basket design on the top and a soccer ball on the bottom. So, and I love it because it's also indicative of why we do the People's Game. Because, you know, every 4 years, and the World Cup is by far the biggest sporting event, the biggest single event in the world every 4 years. I know we don't feel it because we're in the US, which is a relative backwater in the soccer world. But, you know, the rest of the world is like an event that, yes, it is a highly corrupt spectacle in the business of it, which is one of the reasons why we're playing in Qatar in November, right? Is the, again, that the power of that emerging Gulf capital that's like, you know, in this power struggle, I want to say, against the European capital, which has dominated the game for so long. But at the same time, at the grassroots level, at the level of communities, at the level of people, this event unites the world like no other. You know, you have stories like, you know, the movie The Greatest Game, where you have people like nomads going from Outer Mongolia to come in to watch the final. I've been in Brazil where, you know, literally the entire city shuts down when the national team is playing. This is, you know, a game that is indigenous to this continent, right? It emerged in Mesoamerica, but also with rubber from the Amazon, which made up the balls, which is in itself an indicator of how extensive, you know, it gives the lie to the primitive cultures of the Americas, because just the fact that you can go from Tierra del Fuego to you know, northern Georgia and see pre-colonial football pitches. The fact that everybody in the world, you can be in the most obscure nation, in the poorest community, and you know, there's people there with talent that, you know, this is one of those anybody from anywhere can come up and become a great footballer. This phenomenon, it unites and is a stage for conflict, is a stage for solidarity, unity. It's a place where, as we've seen this week in Iran, with the Iranian players refusing to sing the national anthem, and so many Iranian women in the audience in an Islamic country, which is something they can't even do in their home country, you know, showing solidarity for the uprising going on in their country. It is the spectacle and a platform with so many dimensions to it, so many contradictions, that it's almost like the world culture expresses itself through this beautiful game.
I have to just give you two little anecdotes about that. One of the uprisings in Poland was about, you know, trying to raise the price of bread. And bread was so cheap, they didn't dare raise the price of bread because they knew that that would overthrow the regime back when it was a Soviet satellite. But to give you an indication, is that kids played football with the round loaves of bread. It was cheaper than trying to find a ball somewhere. And so that was an indication to the authorities that they ought to raise the price. Second thing is that I almost became, what would we call that? A soccer widow giving birth. I was about to give birth to my son, and it was the World Cup in 1978. And Roberto, my husband, you know, Chilean, all of them were watching every single minute that they could the World Cup. And thankfully, it finished before I went into labor. Just two personal little stories. So, you know, just this notion, because I think if you grow up in the United States, where football is soccer, and soccer is only has only become, you know, famous and popular, what, in the last decade or two. Before that, it was a European, Latin American, rest of the world game, but we had American football. So it's hard for Americans to even understand what you're talking about, how this unifies the world and how the world stops during the World Cup. Doesn't matter what your politics up are or what store you're in or even what pandemic, that everybody stops to watch the World Cup or gets up in the middle of the night to watch the World Cup. It's just that important. Okay, so you've been doing this podcast on the people's game. So there's a side of it, you know, you both hinted at it already, that you want to be able to bring out in your discussions. Can I ask you more about what that is?
Sure. Well, you know, I think in some respects, I think Mel's take on the political subtext of the game is a little bit more celebratory than mine, in that I see a lot of capital co-option of what, and of course the modern game, and I think Mel is in history has borne out, and evidence borne out, that this game, the game of kicking a ball on the ground, was played in many places all over the world, but not particularly Western Europe. And the English game, which emerged out of rugby, actually, was spread around, and the codified rules of the game were spread around with the British Empire. And in England in particular, and what is all of the modern UK now, the game was very much a working class game. In fact, I had the privilege, or maybe that's not the right word, to marry for a while into an English family that were landed gentry traditionally from Essex, and their family looked down on soccer. I thought, oh, I'm marrying into this family, everybody's going to love football. Nope, they're rugby and cricket. And they straight up are like, that's a working class sport. It's not for them. And so this a game really from there and spread around the world, you know, perhaps because it was given, in a sense, everywhere they went as a way to, you know, keep the people they were imperializing more content. The game of soccer was introduced and it became a working class sport all across the world. The United States is really a paradox in that respect. The sport here has been the sport of recent immigrants and the sport of the upper middle class and middle class. You even have the, you know, the cliche of the Volvo driving soccer mother. However, it is worth saying that that made a major contribution to the latest and perhaps greatest ever innovation in the modern sport, which is the development of the women's game, which the United States has played such a central role in. And it exploded here in the United States as a sport that was played both by men and by women. And that was largely unique in terms of the evolution of a sport in a particular nation. There are one or two other countries that joined in that initially too, but real trailblazers in terms of the women's game here in the United States of America. But I think the way that I look at the World Cup and the spectacle of the World Cup is through the lens of high capital spectacle. And so there is an element of the co-optation of the working class, or the efforts to co-opt the working class, in which the game and the World Cup becomes not just a source of contestation, but I also felt like in launching the People's Game, I really wanted to produce a political product during the World Cup that could call out that co-optation and give a big, rude word to the forces of capital and demand the clarity that this is a sport of the people, this is a sport of the working class. And of course, FIFA's corruption makes that expression of that solidarity clear. It also, as a second point, speaks volumes about 21st century capital and where capital investment is spent. And of course, this has never been so pronounced again as it is with the Qatari World Cup, but it's evident everywhere. And I also want to say that it is an important lesson for the left in terms of the creation of spectacle. I don't think that the left internationally ever thinks about the kind of things that are parts of modern existence that capital is able to produce, like the spectacle of the World Cup. Like, very few people I know on the left ever give much thought or consideration to, if we actually had something along the lines of a socialist society, what kind of resources would be deployed to this kind of carnival? And we need to be able, if we're going to be a successful political movement, if we're going to live in the real world, we cannot lie to ourselves, because we will be rejected if we're not able to replicate this, but do it, of course, in a non-exploitative way. But capital resources need to be spent here. And the degree to which people do not recognize the need to have this at the highest level of technology and spectacle, and the left be able to pull it off, we're not going to be popular with people. So there's a lot of questions here for the left. There's a lot of questions here about combating the co-optation of class interests and class struggle. And of course, again, many lessons to be learned about where capital resources are invested by capital and the exploitative manner in which they're invested. So that's the lens that I also try to bring to the People's Game.
Well, and it's very important also because, you know, it's not exclusive to the World Cup, but many sporting events, world sporting events, including the Olympics, does become this contest for capital and infrastructure, capital in particular, between different countries. And unfortunately, and I was in Brazil when much of this was happening during the 2014 World Cup. Governments take the massive influx of capital that a world sporting event gives to gentrify their neighborhoods, to you know, erect white elephant stadiums, exactly. You know, things that, you know, slum clearances. You know, I was in Brazil during a lot of the slum clearances. There are street kids that I know that I never saw after the police sweeps of the streets during the World Cup. You know, South Korea in the Olympics displaced 800,000 people in their quote unquote improvements to host the event. And of course, Qatar being the most blatant, I would say, and the biggest of them all, something like $220 billion was infused into this country for infrastructure and to build these brand new stadiums for the 2022 World Cup, which is orders of magnitude larger than like the most that had been spent on a World Cup previously, which was for Russia in 2018 was something like $13 billion. Wow. So these are high stakes games. That's a high money games that are played. And if you, you know, watch the documentary FIFA Uncovered on Netflix, you know, it really gives an idea of the political positioning of some of the FIFA officials as, you know, almost like puppet masters of the world. Sepp Blatter styled himself as such. The fact that he knew that he could manipulate governments with development money, which is really what FIFA does administrate in between games. And so, yeah, this, you know, Qatar just being, you know, and I know it's being singled out. And of course, there's a lot of Islamophobia that gets infused in the characterization, in the correct characterization, but not the Islamophobia, but the characterization of Qatar as being like kind of the pinnacle of corruption for FIFA. But this is not, of course, the first time that it's been used. I mean, you mentioned, Susie, the 1970 Argentina World Cup, which was played during the dictatorship and was mostly what they call sports washing sort of, you know, events that are used to, I don't know, rehabilitate the image of dictators. Again, World Cup not being exclusive to that. You know, the 1936 Munich Olympics comes to mind. And of course, this World Cup, we are seeing actually a lot of that kind of high drama coming in between the federations themselves and FIFA. So one of the things that has been happening in this World Cup is a dispute over LGBTQ solidarity, in which, of course, LGBTQ identity is banned and illegal in Qatar. And, you know, the nine teams of the European Federation wanted their captains to wear rainbow armbands in solidarity with LGBTQ communities. Qatar put its foot down through FIFA, and so the captains were threatened with sanctions, like game sanctions, if they wore the armbands. In retaliation, Denmark, England, and Germany are, you know, threatening to organize the European teams to withdraw from FIFA altogether. So, you know, there's a lot of this, a lot of world politics that plays out in the politics of the game itself.
I have a couple of questions to ask, because I think what you just did, Melissa, was to answer the question about why is this podcast different from all others, which is to give it a very important political class analysis. But, you know, Alan mentioned that this is now very important for capital, that, you know, this is one place where there's still, I guess, an arena for investment. But he also said that this was a working class game. And I think, you know, the story of England is kind of emblematic here. And I'd like both of you to address to what extent football or soccer is still a working class game. Is it just in the audience? Is it, you know, what remains of that, you know, notion that this was the game of the working class?
Well, you know, Jurgen Klinsmann, the German coach, and by the way, the German team and say the Dutch team, obviously these are broadly social democratic countries with low levels of wealth inequality compared to the contemporary United States or even the UK or most countries in the world. And generally, what Jurgen Klinsmann actually said of American players is they're not hungry enough. They're not from the working class. It's a damn tough sport. You're going to get hurt out there. You're going to get knocked around. You're going to have grit, and you're going to have to want to fight through things, and you're going to have to be pretty rough. And, you know, pampered upper-middle-class kids aren't going to do very well in such a rough. Don't forget, it's the most competitive field in the world. It's the most popular game in the world. Now, almost every child in the world grows up playing soccer. And for a few generations now, outside of the United States and a few other countries, every boy has grown up playing soccer. Every boy has dreamed of being in the World Cup. And they will fight tooth and nail to get there, and they have to be hungry to do it. And, you know, most kids in the world are from the working class, right? Not that many are from the upper middle class or the wealth. There are very few players who have succeeded in the game of soccer who do not come from the working class. Recently, Ecuador is having a very good tournament so far. They have all 10 outfield players in the opening match, and 9 out of 10 in their second were African Ecuadorian. The fans who traveled to Qatar to support Ecuador, not a single black face did I see. Okay? Wow. So that gives you a sense of where the players come from and where the elite fans come from. And by the way, there is a big risk, by the way, of the co-optation of these games by right-wing nationalism. And that's another thing that Mel and I have always been attentive to, is to create a very strong countervailing voice against that in the media and on social media. Now, Mel, please answer Susie's question too, but before we go, if you can also dig up the meme we created for the opening of the Russia World Cup, if you could get that and maybe read that too as we go out.
Sure. I'll answer Susie's question first. However, I absolutely have hope for the people's game as an expression and a cry for justice for the working class. And I'll tell you why. I come from a little bit of a different tradition than Alan does. My fandom, as well as lots of my experience watching soccer and analyzing soccer, comes from the Latin American tradition. I lived in Brazil. I kind of lived and breathed soccer culture down there. And of course, growing up in LA, living and breathing soccer cultures of the Latino community here. Of course, there's a lot of commercial co-optation. Of course, there's a lot of big capital involved. But for Latin Americans, and again, I emphasize the origins of the game, not the formal game, but the play itself in the heart of indigenous culture of this continent, there's always that contradiction. There's always an undercurrent of the global game that will always be grassroots, that will always come from the poor communities in Brazil and in many Latin American cities. And for sure, in almost every city in Brazil, you have an elite team and a working class team. And when you have those local derbies, you know, that class conflict comes out in force in the stands, in the streets. And again, the whole city shuts down. But those contradictions and conflicts and hopes and despairs and dreams get played out in the expression of global football. I also want to say, again, being a big fan of the women's team, and of course, it's not just every boy who dreams of soccer stardom because of the incredible performance of the U.S. women's team. You know, Megan Rapinoe, who comes from very near to where I am now, in the heart of deep red rural Northern California, an openly lesbian, an outspoken progressive who has embraced that tradition of using soccer as a platform for speaking out for justice. The Brazilian who scored that amazing goal the other day, Richarlison, using his platform as a voice for the voiceless, and of course, voicing his support for Lula in the recent election. You know, soccer, like many other cultural expressions, and I'll get a little Gramscian here, is a shared language, and it is a contested terrain on which many social, political, and economic conflicts and struggles play out. I don't think it will ever be completely co-opted by capital. As the former U.S. women's team's captain Abby Wambach said recently, wherever you find soccer, you will find calls for justice. And on that note, here is the call that we put out in the 2018 World Cup for the Global People's Games General Strike. We at the People's Game call for a global general strike, aka universal global vacation, to coincide with the World Cup. We believe this is the only rational and just approach to the world's most popular spectacle. Why the hell should we be distracted by the bull jobs we do slaving for the man when it is our human right, given all the plenty that materialist society has generated, to enjoy a month-long luxurious feast of the world's best cuisine, inebriants, and most joyously of all, football. Let's face it, none of the regular crap that pollutes our mind and the world, Donald Trump, idiot bosses, rush hour traffic, etc., matters one iota for the next 32 days. Now is the time for joy, social solidarity, lung-busting chants, the cooperative ethos of the carnival. In conclusion, we proclaim, shut the system down, fire up the grill, and make technology work for our utopia of the spectacle. Let's break these chains, all power to the people's game.
That particular expression is something I believe in. I think this should be a global holiday. And it should be a global holiday of international working class and class solidarity for all people, for an equal society, for society of equals across the entire world, and for a condemnation of elites and capitalism and exploitation and oppression wherever it exists. That's my vision for a World Cup. I believe, by the way, in a shared labor socialism. And so everybody would love to have 4 weeks off every 4 years. And then the next year for the Women's World Cup, too, where everybody has a Rabelaisian carnival. And the people who do the essential labor get paid twice the normal wage. So double a living wage. But everybody else just does nothing but kick it and enjoy their life and watch a bunch of football matches. I think the world
football
would
work. Socialism. Melissa?
Well, yes, global general strike as world carnival. Yes. Love that as well.
Melissa Figueroa and Alan Minsky, brilliant. There's nothing more to be said until the next time when I can ask you so many more questions about the intersection of football, politics, socialism, capital, investment. And we just, you know, the only thing maybe you talked about it before I got on was Russia and Ukraine war. But definitely there's a football aspect to that, too. I'm going to have to leave it at that. But tell the listeners that you should seek out The People's Game. The podcast is available on Acast and your usual podcasting platforms. But here we're getting a kind of roundup to it. And there's going to be another segment, so don't go away. Alan and Melissa are going to be interviewing author David Goldblatt. Alan Minsky and Melissa Figueroa, thanks for joining us today on Jacobin Radio. Don't go away.
This is Alan Minsky, and I'm here with my co-host, Mel Figueroa. And
hello.
This is the People's Game Takeover. And we are about to talk with David Goldblatt, and he is the author of several books on the histories of global soccer, including The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, and a recent sequel, The Age of Football, Soccer in the 21st Century. And we are going to talk to David about his recent article in the London Review of Books about the Qatari World Cup, which is titled How to Get on TV. And David is currently teaching at Pitzer College here in Southern California. So welcome to Beneath the Surface in the People's Game, David Goldblatt.
Thank you for having me.
How to get on TV. You know, there's been so much focus on the country of Qatar and the controversies surrounding this World Cup in relationship to the country of Qatar. It was easy to forget that only a couple decades ago, one of Qatar's highest profile projects at the time was very much celebrated, indeed, by even the international left, and that is Al Jazeera Television. And so Qatar does seem to be a place full of paradox, and yet is indeed problematic in the ways we've been hearing about so much in the press. And maybe as a way to sort of jump into the middle of things, in media res, as it were, you actually highlight that there's another television project that is even more successful that comes out of Qatar. So what is that television project?
Well, one of the spin-off from Al Jazeera was Al Jazeera Sports, which has mutated into beIN Sports, which is now one of the largest sports broadcasters in the world, and certainly the biggest in the Middle East and North Africa, and hugely important in shaping knowledge of Qatar and spreading Qatar's influence around the world. But it should be understood as just part of a much bigger, more complicated state project to project and make Qatar visible, and not just in the corridors of power, but to mass global publics. You know, Qatar is a small, vulnerable state that has Saudi Arabia, you know, surrounding it by land, which has never reconciled itself really to its independence. It has Iraq and Iran very close north at the end of the Gulf. So how do you protect yourself? What do you do? Well, one of the things you need to do is you need to make yourself visible, and hyperactive diplomacy with both friend and foe, and a hyperactive aid program, and a great deal of mediation and diplomacy work. All of that is good, but it doesn't get noticed beyond the corridors of power. And if you want that, you need to be on television. And if you want to be on television, then football is simply the best thing to get hold of, because nothing in this world, nothing comes close as a popular cultural phenomena. No sport, no artistic form, no music, nothing. Football absolutely sweeps everything away. And so the Qataris have not only got beIN Sports in their diplomatic and political armory, but they have been hosting football tournaments and building football infrastructure now for 15, 20 years. They own Paris Saint-Germain, the biggest club in France, and are conducting a very expensive, if as yet unsuccessful, assault on the heights of European football. They have influential power at UEFA. They are the most gigantic sponsors of global football around the world. And just to top the whole thing off, they won the right to host the World Cup. So we should understand the World Cup, you know, that is going on right now as part of a much bigger sporting, diplomatic, political project by the Qatari state.
Thank you for that. And thank you for that sweeping introduction to Qatar. I remember first noticing Qatar, of course, with Al Jazeera, but then, of course, when Barcelona started sporting the shirts with Qatar on it, which, you know, I was always so proud that they had UNICEF on. And then, you know, all of a sudden, here's this little country that's got its name everywhere. And going into sort of the particular geopolitical and power dynamics around this World Cup, a lot of it seems to be swirling, you know, particularly around the question of LGBTQ rights, the banning of anything resembling a rainbow at the stadiums. And also, you know, it does seem like there's this high political drama involving the European FAs with Denmark, England, and Germany threatening FIFA over the wearing of these armbands, which, you know, of course, it's, as far as LGBTQ solidarity goes, is kind of a token gesture in the first place. But, you know, I really was struck by what you said in terms of Qatar doing this assault on the heights of European capital when it comes to football. So I'd love you to go into a little bit more about that, what you see in terms of the drama unfolding around this tournament. And then, and somewhat related, one thing that I saw kind of going around Twitter was this notion that the turnaround and, you know, the kind of focus on this LGBTQ stuff also might have something to do with Qatar projecting its regional power. I was really fascinated by the kind of feud with Saudi Arabia that you mentioned in the article. Saudi Arabia, you know, launching its own rival network with a really incredibly pettily named Be Out Q. So I'm wondering if you could, you know, first go into the what's happening in this tournament around Qatar and the European FAs, and also what you think about this notion about regional power through some of the stuff that we've seen so far in the tournament.
Lots of things there, Mel. I mean, on the LGBT issue, I think the Qataris actually are probably not unhappy with the degree to which that is getting coverage. And I say that because it means that the migrant worker issue, which is actually the issue that's dominated coverage for the last 10 years of this tournament, and where there are, you know, without going into the debates over numbers, a degree of human misery inflicted over the last decade that I have to say completely exceeds anybody getting their rainbow flag taken away from them, significant and important as that is. And I just want to kind of put that one out there that, you know, there's nobody, no one's getting arrested going into a stadium, you know, making a statement about migrant workers. So that's kind of interesting. On the LGBT issue, I mean, it's reflective that, you know, you have a, and that's a great thing, is that inside global football, there is a small activist network around LGBT issues. And that's great. And, you know, people have conceded this is a really good moment to make those protests. It's a very kind of cut and dried issue for most people. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar. End of story. So it's, you know, it's a good argument to make, whereas the whole migrant worker thing is much more sort of complex and more of a kind of moral quagmire. And we in the global north are all sort of totally complicit in all of that, in a way that the LGBT issue is very, very clear. You know, it's interesting, I would say, that it has become so politicized because certainly in Europe and in North America, you've had players and football federations who have been speaking up on this in different ways. And I think if that hadn't happened, it wouldn't be nearly so much of an issue. So I welcome that. And I think it's great that football associations are taking that lead and that players are supporting that. And this is good. FIFA have clamped down on it, as the Qataris have clamped down on it. I mean, you know, quite who's in charge is hard to know in this situation. I think that's a complex and interesting issue, actually, who's pulling the levers right now. But I think, you know, FIFA stamped on the proposal to wear kind of one love armbands by the captains of the teams by threatening unlimited bookings and sporting sanctions. And also, I mean, just extraordinarily, demanded that the Belgians remove the word love from inside their second kit shirts. I find that, you know, satire truly is dead when that happens. banning love. Come on, guys. I think there's been some overzealous confiscation of items going in. But, you know, the Qataris do want to try and keep a lid on it. You know, they're quite serious about that. And it's good to see that people keep on protesting and going back. And I think this is also true of all the people protesting over Iran and the offering their support to the uprising in Iran and women in Iran. You know, that's sort of going along alongside it. And the rules about what you can take in and out of the stadium are also being applied in that department. So I think it's so extraordinary to see this degree of politicization. And I sort of kind of welcome, that. And, you know, bravo for the people who are brave enough to stand up for these things. And a big shout out for Peter Tatchell, by the way, LGBT leftist activist in the UK who was out there protesting at the Qatar's National Museum, like about, you know, 10 days before the World Cup, and kind of triggered. I mean, I think that kind of triggered and gave momentum to these debates and these arguments. The biggest irony and hypocrisy in all of this is that FIFA are also prosecuting the Ecuadorian and the Mexican football federations for the homophobic chants of their fans. So, you know, that, like, where do you stand, FIFA? Come on, what actually is this? What is this all about? So that's where we stand on, you know, that's where the LGBT issue is. And I think that will keep going. I think, you know, we're not quite over yet. And let's not forget the German team, you know, coming out and covering their mouths for the team photo, which I thought was an amazing statement by players. I mean, again, the degree, like, I can't remember that happening at a World Cup before. You know, that kind of orchestrated protest over something like that, I thought was just amazing. On the regional dynamic, I mean, this, of course, all plays, you know, clamping down on rainbow flags is playing very well in Morocco and Algeria and Egypt and Iraq and lots of other places in the Middle East. So I don't think the Qataris, you know, like, you lose some, you win some on the diplomatic merry-go-round here. And I think that plays well. People say, yeah, stand up for our stuff. You know, this is a Middle Eastern, this is an Arabic, this is an Islamic World Cup. Different people thinking about it in different ways. But I think that wins plaudits in some quarters. I think the most interesting thing has been the Emir of Qatar placing the Saudi flag around his shoulders in the VVIP box after Saudi Arabia won their game against Argentina, and seen walking off arm in arm, old chums, with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And it was only in 2017 that Saudi Arabia led a really serious boycott and virtual siege of Qatar over their support for the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots in Middle Eastern politics, and was supported by Egypt and Bahrain and Kuwait and the UAE. I mean, and it was like, that was serious, serious stuff. It made it very difficult for Qatar in all sorts of ways. And now everybody's chummy. And I thought that was a really extraordinary, that picture will have just reverberated around the Gulf in a way that few other kind of symbols of Saudi-Qatari relationships could. So I think that's a pretty extraordinary piece of political theater.
You know, what you said about the migrant workers, and I too have been disappointed to see that issue almost disappear from the media. And it does remind me of the 2020, of course, virtual Democratic convention, where they had a very long film that was put together, a 12-minute long film that they played when Biden was about to speak. And it showed all of the movements that were civil rights movements and women's rights movements and LGBTQ plus movements. And of course, it left out the labor movement. And I think it's very comfortable for the rights of workers to be left out by neoliberal elites, including well-intentioned liberal journalists or liberal journalists, should I just say, who don't really want to consider the fate of the working class. And in your article, of course, you do highlight the way that this had dominated the objections to the Qatari World Cup, beginning with, of course, the famous Guardian report And you go into it and you talk about the way then that the Qatari government had responded to it with a degree of labor reform, but you hint at the prospect of them reversing. So to follow with what you were just talking about in terms of, and that would be a threat to the regional existence of, I might get this wrong, the Khalifa system, as it's called, which is the system of the exploitation of migrant workers. Do you think it's possible, especially since this has now not really become a prominent part of the protests surrounding the World Cup as it's happening? And you in the article also talk about the way, you know, there were objections leading up to the Russia World Cup, but by the time it started, it all went to the game on the field. That hasn't quite happened this time. So how do you measure, just all of these things, but in particular around the labor question, do you feel that there's a legitimate fear that since it's not front and center of the objections, that we could see a reversion in Qatar and the whole system of the Khalifa labor system not be threatened in the way that maybe it would be if Qatar set an example by having a more just set of labor relations?
I don't think formally it's going to be revoked. I mean, why do so and make trouble for yourself? I mean, there was certainly resistance amongst some Qatari political and business elites who have done very well out of the old system and really didn't want it to change. But I think the consensus, the majority consensus amongst decision makers in Qatar is that it's better, a more modern system suits them both in terms of public perceptions, as well as actually the management of the process. What is really at stake here is to what degree will the laws that have been generated actually be implemented? I mean, it's all about implementation. I mean, we know this in the United States, like you can have a minimum wage, but if nobody's going around checking on employers who are not paying the minimum wage and punishing them, then people will be working for less than the minimum wage. And that, you know, 3-4 times over in Qatar, over expenses, the use of foreign agents, you know, and with people ending up in kind of debt to them, which is illegal but widespread, terms and conditions, safety regulations, some kind of meaningful legal redress, which is sort of promised, but in actual fact, without supplying, you know, a workers' center and, you know, independent attorneys of some kind or another, etc. You know, this is all pie in the sky. So I think the most likely thing is that Qatar will not revert, but will probably continue to have a pretty unjust an unimplemented system.
This is very interesting and curious because, you know, I mean, this, of course, is not the first time that a tyrannical country has used a global sporting event to oppress people. Brazil, I was in Brazil, not during the World Cup, but in the run-up and then also afterwards, you know, looking at all of the displacements, the slum clearances, friends of mine that went missing when they were arrested and I don't know what happened to them since, etc. You know, and in the Olympics, of course, in Korea, 800,000 people being displaced for the massive infrastructure projects that are a part of world sporting events and are used by countries as world sporting events. What I think is interesting and which strikes me a little different about Qatar is that, you know, those nations have, for the most part, oppressed their own people, whereas Qatar has this global workforce. It's almost this like kind of global regional proletariat, including Filipinos, which are my people, you know, Africans, South Asians, etc. So, and then of course, you know, more than the rainbow issue, the fact that there are like kind of like places outside the migrant worker camps where they can watch the games, but that no journalist is allowed to film or record in any way. Yeah, I wonder about that. I wonder what the sort of international implications are of sort of, you know, Qatar's super exploitation of a global proletariat, so to speak. And also what's going to happen after the games are done.
I think the first thing to say is Qatar is so not alone in this. You know, we're picking Qatar out, and of course, you know, with visibility comes scrutiny, but Qatar is by no means the only or the worst employer of a global mobile proletariat. I mean, Saudi Arabia is about to embark on the most absurd kind of scale of infrastructure building that may actually dwarf what has gone on in Qatar in the last decade. The same applies in the UAE. And, you know, we know migrant labor is treated poorly by capital pretty much everywhere. So I think that's sort of worth remembering. I mean, in that regard, you know, Qatar forces, certainly those of us in the global north, kind of come face to face with our own complicity and enmeshment in all of this, you know, because of course it's not just like wild World Cups going on. I mean, every football shirt and every football that is made is reliant, if not on migrant labor, then on, you know, very, very vulnerable, very poor, ununionized labor in really tough places, earning virtually nothing. So I think that, you know, that in a way, I think is a good thing. It's like, God, we all really need to be brought face to face with that. And I just wanted to say, Alan, in response to your point, there is some journalistic work being done on migrant workers still. You know, people are getting into the migrant camps and, you know, the spaces where migrants are allowed to watch the World Cup, which are often like cricket stadiums, because actually that's what a lot of the migrant workers play. They're watching the football in those spaces. And I've been in Qatar, and however curated it is, and it's a very curated space, the cracks appear all the time. You know, you can't but not see the incredible inequalities, the racialized dimension of those inequalities in its kind of labor market and in everyday life. It's really, ooh, you know, given that folks can't drink either, so you've got to look at it straight in the eye, it's very tangible. Mm-hmm. So I think that will be interesting to hear how people kind of experience that and sort of report that. I mean, I think after the World Cup, Mel, one of the main things is there'll be a lot less building. I think there'll be many fewer, certainly construction workers. I mean, I think even Qatar's had enough construction already. And, you know, they've had anywhere between 800,000 to 1 million South Asian single men doing that bit of the work. And I think actually the workforce will fall, is my guess. There will be less of this. I mean, there may well be more domestic labor. We will see. Yeah. So I'm not sure that was slightly a rambling answer to your question.
We are speaking with David Goldblatt, and he is the author most recently of a article in the London Review of Books called How to Get on TV. It reviews two books related to the Qatari World Cup and is an essay about the history of Qatar leading up and through the World Cup. And I have to say, there is a break in the essay, and then there's some final paragraphs that I find particularly fascinating. So people should find the article online and read it. And that concerns that kind of lives people do actually lead among the Qataris, and how underreported that is and can be, and misunderstood in all of the reporting or not represented. So it's a fascinating sort of coda to the article. I did want to ask you, though, of course, before we finish here, your thoughts on the tournament so far. And of course, in the article, you do have a point of sort of realism. And I think to a degree, even the likes of Yumi and Mal are guilty of loving the games on the field. So we do want to maybe hear your thoughts about the games on the field. But in relation to what we've spoken about so far, of course, Qatar, and by the way, I think I got this wrong in today's podcast, are so far the one team that has been eliminated from any chance to get to the second round. And what's your sense now, having written this article and studied Qatar, what kind of, if any, negative impact that may have on the experience of this for Qataris or for the politics of Qatar?
Oh, I think Qatar going out, they discounted that a long time ago. That was baked in. I really don't think it makes a huge amount of difference. I mean, if they had actually gone on a run, you know, the way the Russians did in 2018, yeah, that would have been, you know, there definitely would have been a real local response. But I don't think in the big picture, it makes a huge difference. On the field, I mean, the moment for me, you know, the one moment of real joy that just like actually burned everything else out was Richarlison's goal for Brazil. You know, he's pretty much the only kind of supporter of Lula amongst the players. Though don't forget that Titi, the coach, is definitely a Lula supporter and refused to embrace Bolsonaro when they won the Copa America in Brazil. Very pointedly, he refused to embrace Bolsonaro in the trophy, the sort of walk to get the trophy, and then embraced the head of the Brazilian Football Federation very fulsomely next to him. So that was just amazing. What a goal. What a piece of skill. What an unbelievable, balletic, extraordinary moment. So that was that brought me joy. I really enjoy Canada giving it a really good go. That was, you know, what's not to like. Got a real soft spot for the Ecuadorians, you know, overwhelmingly Afro-Ecuadorian team from 3% of the population who get treated really badly the rest of the time. So good power to those guys. England, you know, a bit stodgy, a bit dismal. But, you know, welcome to England these days. You know, as ever, the national team doing, you know, a sterling job of reflecting the state of the nation. Though I do think there's, I'm sure there's better to come. You know, Japan, Germany. Wow. Sometimes, you know, that's football, isn't it? Just sometimes the world just, you know, for 90 minutes, the world can be turned upside down. So more of that, please.
And your predictions for the final?
Well, what do I know? I mean, you know, I actually had a, I have, well, every World Cup, I have a bet, $10 on who's going to win. And in 2018, I had my $10 on France. And this time around, I put my $10 on Argentina. So we'll see. After today, you know, we're still in the game. And it's a romantics bet, you know, isn't it? Because it's for Messi. So at the moment, I like really, you know, I think the French are looking good without being, you know, super exciting. I just think they've got a feel of a team who, even if they're not very good on the day, can still win a game. And I think that counts quite a lot, actually, in tournament football. So I'm going to say, you know, heart Argentina, head France, you know, wild utopian possibility, you know, England.
Oh, well, with that, we will wrap up. And this has been an interview for The People's Game and The People's Game Takeover of Beneath the Surface on KPFK Radio with author David Goldblatt. His most recent article is How to Get on TV in the London Review of Books. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you
so much, of course, to my co-host, Mel.
Thank you.
That's it for today's and special installment of The People's Game.